from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, I'll share the story with you. An American tourist was killed by a train as he walked on the tracks in a daze after he drank a cappuccino laced with drugs. And then he was robbed, railway police in Rome, Italy, said last week. Frank Pell, 74, of California, died early Friday at the suburban Turbitia station, the police official said. This is the interesting part, is that the suspect robber, a 54-year-old Italian man, was arrested Saturday, had chatted with Pell and his wife before fetching them cappuccinos at a local cafe, and then he added a mix of drugs, including sleeping pills. I wanted to bring on Pat Brown. You all know Pat Brown as an investigative criminal profiler, to talk about this safety issue as far as traveling goes. In fact, she's going to share a couple of stories with you about her own family, and we're going to profile these types of criminals that prey on tourists. In this case, it was a poor American in Italy, 74, and here he is in a drug daze, and he gets ran over by a train. I don't think he can get much more depressing than that. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Now, you've got a couple of stories of your own to share with the audience, if you want to, about your own family, and then we're going to get right into this whole travel issue.
Well, I tell you, people, you know, traveling is the greatest thing in the world. I love it, and I've always enjoyed traveling. And over time, I've noticed that I have different issues to deal with from the time when I went to Africa when I was 19 and from the time I'm traveling when I'm 52.
Right.
There's sometimes different issues, especially with young women being out there in bars and dating and meeting young men. And at 52, when they kind of ignore you, so then you become a target for a different reason. But we all have to be careful when we travel and making our decisions. And I think the biggest problem that travelers have is they don't see themselves through other people's eyes, through people of that country, and especially through the criminals of that country. And so sometimes Americans sort of arrogantly just mosey along thinking everything's, I'm perfectly fine, I have the right to do this and the right to do that. And many times you actually, yeah, you have the right, but you may get yourself killed doing it. An example would be when I went to Morocco when I was 21, I never considered the culture for a minute. I wore a pair of tight jeans, a tube top, because those are popular in the 70s. I wore tight jeans and a tube top in a Muslim country where women were covered from head to toe.
Right.
And thought, well, you know, I'm an American. And I do remember standing in the middle of the street having a man threaten my life if I did not have sex with him. And there were police officers standing nearby, and they just were not doing a thing about it.
Yeah, talk
and
about it.
I remember being very frightened, and now looking back, I think, what an idiot. You know, what was I thinking walking around like that? Because unfortunately, that when I walked around like that and I talked to young men, they immediately labeled me somewhere between a prostitute and a whore, and felt I got what I deserved, and so did the police. And that I put myself in a terribly dangerous situation.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not making light of any of these situations, but that target circled on your back is there when you're a tourist. You don't expect it. We've covered the, you know, the Natalie Holloway stories and all those sorts of stories, but this is a 74-year-old mature man in Italy, has a cappuccino and gets drugged and robbed and then ran over by a train. You just gave your own personal example of a story. Americans and Canadians, North Americans are traveling all over the world. And that culture aspect is so important. Not only will they target females, but they'll target males, or they'll target anyone that they think they can.
That's true. And I think, you know, the other problem is it's not so much that sometimes, but the fact that we let our guard down when we're on vacation, because we're having fun, and we think everything is sunshining and beautiful. And, you know, so the sun shines and the sky is gorgeous. We tend not to think we're in danger. And so here we are in a beautiful country, and we're feeling all happy. And, of course, we love to meet the people there because that, you know, that enriches our experience. So while at home, if somebody offered to get us some cappuccinos, we'd look at them and go, well, what are you doing that for?
Yeah, exactly.
but we let our guard down because we're someplace else, and we think, quote, the natives are just being friendly. And, you know, and then surely the rest of the people in the country probably would be just being friendly, but we may be targeted by somebody who is not quite so lovely. And we have to keep that in mind and keep our eyes open, especially when we're accepting drinks. And, of course, this mostly happens in bars. This story is unusual because it's a cappuccino and it's an older couple. But my daughter was just recently in Portugal, and she was at a bar, and a young man bought her a couple of drinks, and when she wouldn't leave with him, he threatened her, and then he followed my daughter and her friend out of the place, tried to get in the taxi that they were getting into on the street, tried to, you know, prevent them from doing that and follow them and get in there with them. And they were actually quite frightened because, you know, they were, you know, not expecting that from the happy atmosphere of the young people in the bar. So young or older, we can all become targets if we're not careful about who we're hanging out with.
Absolutely. Pat Brown's here. She's a investigative criminal profiler. We're talking about traveling and safety. You mentioned it earlier, but I think we should bring it up again because it's so important. Even if you are careful, you get approached and you're worried about a certain person or persons that may be bothering you, the country that you're in, the local law enforcement may not be too cooperative with you, and that's something else that you should consider.
Exactly. My daughter actually went into the Portuguese police station, and she herself is a police officer in the U.S.
Right.
And she even showed them her badge, and they just shrugged their shoulders and said, "Well, you're okay."
Yeah.
They wouldn't even take the report down. So she wasn't too happy about that they would not even look for this man. And then on top of that, they had the picture of the man on camera because she had her camera with her, and she showed them the picture. "This is the guy who just tried to rob me." And they didn't do a thing about it.
You know,
that was surprising.
The travel agents and all the media hype and stuff we see, you know, travel here, travel there. It doesn't, they don't do a lot as far as protecting the people or trying to get the people to protect themselves when they do this sort of traveling. Let's talk about the typical criminal element that will target a tourist or tourists because, again, you know, I hate to use that same analogy, but when you're walking around with that target on your back, there is that element out there. And yes, they're in the United States looking for the tourists too, but in this case we're talking about foreign countries. Let's talk about that criminal element.
Well, you know, one thing that I have found pretty much to be true is the majority of the time you're in danger is when you do the same things you do here. You get drunk and you're in a dark place.
Yep.
When I traveled in a lot of countries alone as a female, people said, "How do you do that?" And I said, "Well, I stay with those women and children." Because generally speaking, whether there are women and children, you have, it's either daylight, or you're on a crowded bus, or you're in a crowded shopping area, and outside of being pickpocketed or being possibly touched, your likelihood of you being, you know, dragged off and kidnapped, raped, stabbed in an alley is not great. But when you go to a bar and you're hanging out, or you're getting drunk, and then you're walking back to your hotel down a side street, you're putting yourself in danger, and that's what we really have to be careful of, is finding ourselves separated from the herd, just like we would be separated here. That we're simply in the middle of nowhere, and that can get us in a lot of trouble.
You know, something that you wouldn't do at home doesn't necessarily mean that you should do it when you're on vacation. And, you know, we're not talking to children, but this talking to strangers. And, you know, you want to be friendly and you want to visit. But typically, and we've heard several cases of this, all of a sudden you're an American in a foreign country and another male comes up and talks to you and says that he's American and, you know, he wants to befriend you. Sometimes those are the ones that are out there to target you because they want to find a vulnerability, and they know that you're looking for your own kind.
Oh, yeah, that's very true. And you have to ask yourself, when this person is traveling around, what's the story that goes with them? And yes, you're quite right. A lot of times you're like, oh, so a friendly face and someone I can speak my own language with and someone I can go hang out with. And yes, indeed, you can really, they really do target other lone Americans. And so that's a very good point, something to be aware of. I want to point something else at you. When you're in another country, one thing you want to do is find out what the locals will do as well.
Yep.
Because sometimes you forget to real they. They would say, "Hey, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't go there. No, 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 don't take those cabs." Like in Mexico, there's a lot of gypsy cabs, and if you get into them, you'll be finding that they'll be driving you around for 2 days, having you remove money from ATMs, and if you're lucky, you'll survive it. So there's a lot of, you know, people say watch out for certain cabs. And so this is a wise thing to find out from the locals, you know, what they do. I was just on a train in southern India, and one gentleman, we thought, well, he's smart. We didn't think of that. He came on with his luggage into our cabin, and he put his suitcase underneath the seat. And then he put a chain on it with a lock, and he locked it on. And, oh, I see you're locking it. And he goes, I don't trust people. I'm not going to have my, I want to be able to see mine. And so and my son and I just stuck our things underneath there and said, well, hope it's still there in the morning.
Well,
he didn't have that lock. So we thought that guy had a good idea, and probably he had traveled the trains quite a bit and was aware that was possibly a problem on the train. So I thought, oh, that was wise.
Something that
luckily our luggage stayed with us. No.
Something that people don't do, and, you know, I've even talked with Beth Holloway about this, as far as, you know, making sure that you have your cell phone, it's charged, people know your number, that you've given them your itinerary, where you're staying, your telephone number, all that sort of stuff. It's so important that people know what you're doing. Yeah, you may want to get away and get away from the rat race, so to speak, but somebody out there should know about you, because all of a sudden you disappear and nobody knows where you are. It makes it three times as difficult.
Well, that's true, but, you know, I have to admit that sometimes you can't possibly give up your itinerary. When I met my son recently and we traveled to India, our itinerary changed rather rapidly.
Yeah.
And we half the time didn't know where we were staying and what hotel we were in, because I came into Mumbai like at 11 o'clock at night on the flight, and all I knew was I was flying to Kashmir in a couple of days, and I wanted to be near the domestic airport. And a gentleman ran up with his card around his neck and said, are you looking for a hotel? Which indeed we were. And he said, okay, come. We, you know, we have a hotel just 2 minute drive. And of course, we just jumped in the vehicle. You could say this is rather rash, because I don't know who this man is at 11 o'clock at night or the people that were with him. And they indeed took us to a hotel, and they turned out to send a driver for us the next day, and it was great, which is the way it works a lot of times in India. But, you know, there is a level of risk. And, I, you know, looking back, I could think, well, maybe that wasn't smart. But kind of knowing the way India works, that usually turns out well. But, yes, you know, sometimes you don't quite know where you're going to be and what's going to happen to you. So it is a problem. I think that's just a risk of traveling. I think there's certain levels of risk. But some people have asked me, since we were up in Kashmir, you know, what about the terrorism issue?
Yeah.
You know, and when we came to the airport in Kashmir, coming from Mumbai into Kashmir, we got patted down 6 times. So I was at least glad to see they were doing really good security. And then we stayed for two days and nights there. We had a wonderful time. We saw a lot of people, a lot of the army and police standing around with, you know, their automatic weapons about every few feet or so. And so it was very heavily armed. And, you know, we knew there was a slight risk in what we were doing, but we wanted to see Kashmir, and we thought it was relatively safe considering at the moment, and so we went. And then we came back to Delhi for a week. I came home, and my son went on to Jaipur, which they blew up about a week after he arrived with the 7 bombs, and Jaipur went off. So,
wow.
You know, it wasn't Kashmir that could have killed us. It was Jaipur. So, you know, I went into a panic because, of course, I didn't know where he was and called him. It took me 30 minutes to get his phone to ring, and finally he answered, and he was safe. But you never know. I mean, you know, as far as terrorism goes, where things are going to strike and not. So I don't terribly much worry about it, because I figure, you know, you can run from it, but you can run to it, so who knows?
Yeah.
You go from one place, and then you think you're leaving that dangerous place, you end up someplace else, and you get hit there. So
well, that's true.
I just say enjoy life and enjoy travel.
Absolutely, that's true. And just before we change topics, one thing that, and it may be difficult to know, but it's also important that, you know, laws are meant to be on the books, and when you travel, don't break them, because the penalties in the countries that you're traveling in may be 10 times as harsh. I've done stories on this program about, you know, foreign nationals that end up in another country, and all of a sudden they're in jail without a trial for 2 or 3 years. And trying to figure out how to get out. So if you if you do the crime, you're going to do even more time in a lot
right.
of these places you go to.
Think about it. You know, this again is American arrogance, or arrogance of any tourist going to any other country, not just Americans that do this. We are a visitor in their country, and
yep.
we have a duty to be respectful of their laws and of their culture. So I believe we should not run around dressed in any way we please, because we think we We should. When I was in Egypt a couple years ago, I covered my head when I was traveling because that was their culture. And although I'm a big feminist and I don't particularly like, you know, the concept that women have to do this, I also wanted to be respectful because people who were in that area were not prepared to deal with a woman running around with her head uncovered. That made them uncomfortable. And so there's no reason for me to make everybody uncomfortable just because I don't agree necessarily with the concept. And so one must respect the local culture and one must respect the laws. We're visiting the country. If you don't want to be respectful of that country when you go there, please stay home. Nobody's making you go. But to just go over and flaunt, and I actually was embarrassed many times by Europeans and Americans when I was I had taken a trip down to the Sinai Peninsula, and the lack of clothing on so many of the Europeans and Americans within that culture was just absolutely embarrassing, and I felt, please get dressed. It was too stark a difference from the local culture, and I thought it was very, very disrespectful.
You know, I think the best advice to anyone is use your sixth sense when you're traveling, because it's a built-in defense mechanism, and hopefully we won't hear any more tragedies. Well, I've got you.
Stay with women and children.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, I've got you. We've talked about this in past shows. We keep hearing about these college co-ed murders. The young people are still dying. I'm not sure if it's just we're hearing about it more, and it's really the statistics are no different than what they've been for a while. But sadly, we're hearing about this university and that university and these young people that are being taken so tragically. Your thoughts on what's been going on recently here?
Which murder are you speaking here of?
Well, there's been all sorts. You know, every time you turn on the television, there's another college co-ed being killed somewhere.
Well, I think we're running into two major problems. One is the fact that drinking has gotten completely out of hand.
Exactly.
And nobody wants to face that fact. Binge drinking is hugely out of hand. We're not even just talking about going out and getting a little happy. We're talking about extreme drinking where people are totally trashed out of their minds. And this is one of the reasons that silly smiley killer gang theory has cropped up with all the young men who've drowned up in the north.
Yep.
Through the northern states. The most recent one is a gentleman in Vermont, a young man in Vermont, just found, just today, I believe his body was found, and they're trying to attribute that to these smiley face killers. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that there's some couple of detectives out in New York, ex-detectives, I mean, they're retired, have really put themselves in to do a lot of work on this, and I respect them for that, but I think the theory is ludicrous. They think that there's some kind of gang, I suppose, that gets together on the internet and they somehow target handsome, intelligent college men, mm-hmm. some kind of revenge thing, and they go out and they drown them all over the place. I don't know, it makes no sense. But supposedly they're attributing like 40 deaths of young college men to this, who've all ended up in the water. But what they're not looking at is the fact that you're talking about a lot of colleges in the north, very big population, very drunk young men, very drunk, who are all near water. Like, for example, in Minnesota, you have a young man who his death was actually a homicide, not the Smiley Killers one, but it was another issue. But you take a lot of these Minnesota, Wisconsin. In Minnesota, you've got 10,000 lakes. It's easy to fall in the water if you're drunk. You can't do it in New Mexico so easily, but in New Mexico, you end up drunk and dead in the water. So I think there's just a big problem with binge drinking, and people do stupid things when they're drunk, and they get themselves killed, either because they get hypothermic out in the cold and they lose their way and they fall in the water, or they crash the vehicles, or they become victims because they're so drunk they can't protect themselves.
Yep.
I think drinking is one of the number one issues. And the second one, I think, is that people are away from home and they get in relationships with people they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Or they used to stay close to home and they used to be near their parents and they used to get into relationships with people who were from town. You kind of knew their background. And now, simple fact is, you're meeting people you don't know who they are and they're getting involved too quickly. And usually sexual relationship as well, so that the bonding is very quick and you're not as cautious. And then there becomes the stalker problem when the guy gets mad and ends up killing you off. So I think those are the two number one issues we're looking at, drinking. And then drinking, women going to bars, getting drunk, and then, you know, getting separated from the herd again and getting raped and murdered.
Yep. And I think that's so important, Pat, and you hit the nail on the head as far as the drinking issue goes and the college campuses across North America. It seems like there's no consequences for these kids. There's, you know, the rules are so lax, and maybe I'm just getting too old-fashioned, but, you know, and we all expect the kids are going to do this, but it just seems like it's totally out of control. And when they're out of control themselves, of course, their mental faculty is impaired by alcohol or drug or whatever, and obviously their victimization, whether it's by accident or by, you know, by crime, is going to be a lot easier, and I think that needs to be looked at a little bit more.
Absolutely, because I think, you know, in general speaking, when you're not drinking, I mean, there's a whole lot less things that are going to happen to you. Your senses are going to be about you, so you're not going to get yourself into troublesome situations like this. Very often, you have the occasional person, but now I think, yes, I think it's really gotten out of hand, and I think that the colleges are doing very little about it. I always think back to the Duke investigation.
Yep.
What bothered me about that investigation was not so much that I thought the girl was a total fat liar.
Yep.
I personally think they hired her. She was an escort, and she claimed she was there to dance them. Let's face it, you have two more, you work more than 2 days with an escort service, you're a prostitute, because otherwise you don't keep your job. So we know she's a prostitute, and I'm guessing there was an issue over money here more than anything else. But here's my thing. You got these young men, what was it, hockey team? I can't remember what they were.
Lacrosse team.
The Duke players, what team were they on?
They were a lacrosse team.
Lacrosse team, okay. I'm not sure how much I watch sports. Okay, so you have these young men, not only are they going to your college, but they're representing your college, and a lot of them, I believe, are on scholarships.
Yep.
So you're paying for them to be at your college, represent your college, the finest of Duke, and they're out there having parties with hookers.
Yep.
And getting drunk.
Yep.
I'd say, at that point, toss them all out of the school and say, look, we don't tolerate this. We pay for you. We pay for you to come here. We don't expect you to be doing this kind of thing. But apparently that's just not the issue. And so they, I think, embarrassed the college, and yet the college didn't respond.
Yeah, you're right. Set the example, but in a lot of cases, it's a bad example. Pat Brown, investigative criminal profiler. Her webpage is www.patbrownprofiling.com. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks, Dan.
We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to be back here in just a minute with former DA and author of And Justice for Some, Wendy Murphy. But just before we switch to a PSA, I just got this email from Drew Kesey. You know Drew Kesey as Jennifer Kesey's dad. Jennifer's been missing far too long. It says, we've just received the air date for the CBS 48 Hours piece on Jennifer Kesey. It will air June 14th, that's Saturday, June 14th at 10 o'clock. Check your local listings for your CBS channel and pass this on to anyone else you know. And hopefully this CBS profile on the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey will lead to some information regarding her whereabouts. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is the Dana Pretzer Show, and we'll be back in just a minute with Wendy Murphy.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. You all know that the Rebecca McEvoy case will hopefully come to a head, or at least some decisions be made on June 10th down in Mobile, Alabama. And one of the things that's going to be considered is a gag order. And we hear this gag order conversation all the time about judges, and usually it's the defense that jumps up and says that so-and-so's talking too much, or we need a gag order, or this doesn't need to be into the press. And not a lot of people understand what a gag order is all about. So what I thought I would do is go to one of our most popular guests here on the program, former DA, current author of And Justice for Some. Check out the website for the book on our website. The link there, Wendy Murphy. Wendy, as you know, is a TV commentator, law professor, former DA. And, you know, Wendy, I know you've been on, you know, hundreds of TV shows, but I think I got a first on everyone else tonight. Tonight, you're going to be on the same show as a guy who has a sweet potato that looks like Barack Obama. He's on after you. No, I don't know if you, you know, the election's settled now because this guy says he has this sweet potato. I've seen the sweet potato. I don't think it looks like Barack Obama, but anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway.
I've never been speechless when you mix vegetables and politics. I gotta rewind my software.
Anyway, you are aware of the McEvoy case. We've discussed it before, and the gag order which will apparently be decided, although there have been so many continuances in this case, on June 10th, is something that has everyone raising an eyebrow, including the family. They're worried that they won't be able to speak, come on this program or other programs again. Let's talk about gag orders.
Yeah, well, there's so much to say. First thing is, I have actually two different chapters in my book that relate to this topic. One is about the nature of strategic delays. I know that's a little bit tangential, but this case has been going on for so long. It is unconscionable how they keep dragging this out. And I think part of it is simply that the defense and maybe even the judge, they just want the press to die down because they don't like that kind of oversight. So if they just drag the case out until people stop paying attention, then if they do something untoward, fewer people will be watching.
Right.
I wish I could say that's rare. It isn't. But again, I have a chapter about the way that delay is used strategically, and it relates to gag orders in the sense that it's sort of a different way of keeping the press from shining an antiseptic light on the business of the government. And, you know, it's to me, as an American, it's probably one of the most frustrating and offensive things that I see happen in the criminal justice system. You know, this place that purports to be doing the people's business, spending the people's money, you know, promoting the idea on the world stage that we do it better than anybody else, and then maybe more importantly, that we really, really care about free speech and publicity is a good thing for a democracy and so forth.
Right.
Well, yeah, except when the government doesn't want people to know that they're not getting the job done. So gag orders are part of this insidious little ploy, if you ask me, and I maybe ploy is too strong a word, but the bottom line is, Dana, gag orders are court rulings that command certain people not to speak publicly.
Right.
And the first thing I do when I hear about gag orders is I raise my eyebrow and I you know, engage my cynical brain and say, gag orders around the most important business of the government? We're talking about taking away someone's liberty and or being fair in doling out justice. Shouldn't the public be able to speak and scream and yell and talk and watch with the brightest light possible shining on the way the business of the people is being done in this context? And so gag orders to me are so anathema to what this country stands for. That's thing one. Thing two is, isn't it interesting how, and this is the other chapter that relates so magnificently and so frustratingly to the delay problem, the strategic delay problem in our system, it's that gag orders, generally speaking, only work as against the good guys.
Right.
If a judge says to a prosecutor, you cannot speak to the public, the reason prosecutors tend to obey the order, you know, don't tell the public how bad the evidence is. Don't tell the public how strong your case is. Don't tell the public, you know, that you've got confidence in your case and so forth. Because if you do, I'm going to suppress evidence or I'm going to dismiss the charges and poof, your case goes away. I will punish you, big bad government, for speaking publicly, even if truthful, because I don't want you to do it. Now, sometimes there are good arguments about why the judge wants that. They don't want juries to be infected with an unfair sense of the case. They don't want too much publicity because of what we all have understood is the so-called Sam Shepard problem, which is when mobs show up and, you know, say, off with his head. We don't want that. And I understand mob justice is a bad thing. But when you say to the government, don't say anything publicly, and the government has to be obedient lest the case get tossed or the evidence get suppressed, that's one side of the coin. When that same gag order is issued against the defense, and very often the order doesn't distinguish, but the defense could care less about complying because there are no sanctions.
Yep.
What's a judge going to do to a defense attorney or to a defendant or the defendant's shills and cronies and buddies and, you know, defense attorneys, wink, wink, who work the TV shows on behalf of the bad guys and talk up a storm about utter nonsense? and taint the jury pool and distort the truth and make the business of the people harder to get done in a fair way and create cynicism and distrust among you know, regular folks about what the hell are you doing? You call this justice? So the long story is gag orders can be a good idea if they could effectively gag both sides in a way that would be fair, literally cleanse the process of the outside influences that sometimes distort rather than elucidate the truth. I might like gag orders better. But when it only shuts up the good guys and the bad guys, you know, engage in a dog and pony show and persuade the world that up is down and black is white, and there's nothing you can do about it, because you can't punish the defense. You can't lock up the defendant because his lawyer disobeyed a gag order. And what are you going to do? Sanction the defense attorney? $20, you know, $20,000 fine? What do they care? They'll factor it into the cost of doing business and send the bill to the client.
Exactly.
It's not a fair idea. Gag orders, and that's why I'm opposed to them.
We all know Drew Peterson, the former police officer who was suspected in the disappearance of his wife, and his attorney, Joel Brodsky, has done every media appearance that he can, including my program. And he told me on air, and this ties into the gag order part of it somewhat, that he wants as much publicity as he can. And lo and behold, what happens? Drew Peterson gets arrested on a firearms charge about a gun that he had with an over-length barrel. And I watched the press conference with a DA in Illinois and a sergeant from the Illinois State Police. And guess what happened? That media scrum was very pro Drew Peterson. Why are you doing this now? Why is this happening now? Are you picking on Drew Peterson? And you know what? Joel Brodsky, I think, played his cards very well, or am I wrong?
No. You're just emphasizing my point, which is that the power of the gag order is only as effective as the system's ability to protect against its misuse. So when one side has to be quiet, but the other side can lie with impunity or distort the public's perception with impunity,
yep,
or manipulate all the potential jurors with impunity, as I think we're watching with the Peterson case. By the way, we also watched it with the other Peterson case.
Exactly.
Lacey Peterson case. My goodness. I mean, who doesn't remember the crocodile tears coming out of Scott Peterson's Ken doll fake tears.
Yeah.
Absolutely intentional. Designed, in fact, to make the public and thus the jurors really struggle to accept that he's the type of person who could kill. So, you know, Drew Peterson is no dummy. He's a cop with years and years of experience. He knows when he's been a cop trying to arrest the bad guys and watch the lawyers do the dance. In his cases, he learned a few tricks. Everybody knows the tricks, except for the regular public trying to understand what the truth is in a case where they're only getting one side story, and that side story isn't even close to the truth. They're just making stuff up, and the other side has a gag on. I think one of the most frustrating examples of this, again, this is all in my book, it comes from the Kobe Bryant trial.
Right.
Remember that Kobe Bryant's attorney said in court one day something about the victim having sex with three men in 3 days. And everybody went crazy. The court stopped for the day, and that was the headline for days on end. Indeed, it's still the headline. If you read anything about the case, it says something about sex with three men in 3 days.
Yep.
When the victim's private attorney, somebody like me, a third-party private attorney in a criminal case, issued a public statement the next day and said, it's false, that's not true, it's a lie, the judge in that case dragged that lawyer in, the victim's lawyer, and said, if I said there's a gag order here, and I told you not to say anything publicly, and you had no right to issue that press release, it violates my order, and if you do it again, I'm going to throw you in jail for contempt. Now, mind you, Kobe Bryant's lawyer didn't technically violate the gag order, because what she said in court. But she lied, and she didn't get dragged in and punished. That's the problem with gag orders. Not only do they allow the false statements to go unredressed, they literally threaten the good guys who are trying to tell the truth. So poor, you know, the poor victim's lawyer had to choose then between incarceration and letting lies become the myth of the story. To me, that is the most insulting way to run a legal system. And a lot of defense attorneys would say to you, "Oh no, this is a source of pride. This is how we do it here. This is good. This is cool. This is strategy, man. This is manipulation. This is trial 101. And I disagree with that. I think it's insulting. I think it's un-American. I think there's no such thing as a constitutional right to, you know, engage in smoke and mirrors and trick the public into thinking a guilty person is in fact innocent. You're entitled to a fair trial. There's no constitutional right to trick people into believing nonsense."
You know, the McAvoy family, dad, cousins, you've spoken with them over email, and I've had them on the program. To say salt of the earth is an understatement for these people. And they keep hearing from the defense attorneys, fair. We have to be fair. The trial has to be fair. He has to have a fair, everything has to be fair. And these people, and I want you to put your victim's advocate hat on, Wendy, these people are saying, well, what about fair to us? What about fair to the family? And they're getting so disappointed. In fact, the dad, a police officer himself for 25 years, is they're starting to get so frustrated with the system that they think this will never end. How do you deal with that? How do you speak to them?
Well, one of the things I say, which is really sad, is when you look at the Constitution and it talks about the right to a fair trial, it is talking about people accused of crime. It isn't talking about law-abiding citizens. And, you know, like it or not, that is what the Constitution says. On the other hand, most of the Bill of Rights applies with equal force to all people, not just people accused of crime. And we forget that sometimes. There are constitutional rights, and fairness, I think, is implicit in the idea that a legal system can be just. And if you only make the legal system fair and just for the bad guys, you can't have a legal system. It will collapse under the weight of its own fraud. So what I say to people is, look, it's hard, and it really is an uphill climb, but, and this is what I said to Rebecca's family, it is unconscionable to me that you're being told you can't speak when everything you're doing is simply asking questions about how the law works, whether it's being done fairly, and you want people to pay attention, because if people pay attention, you're more likely to get a fair result than if nobody pays attention. That's not a bad thing to do, and I would do it. If I were watching a case involving one of my loved ones. But when they went to court around the gag order, the issuance of the gag order, I did send them a bunch of emails, and I've been trying to help them as best I can, although I don't practice in that area, and I can't really give them formal legal advice. I'm helping them, giving them informal suggestions and advice.
Right.
But one of the things I said was, you're not a party to the criminal case. The names of the parties in a criminal case are criminal defendant versus state versus criminal defendant. I don't care which person you put on which side of the V. The bottom line is the victim is not a party. And because the victim is not a party, and of course when the victim is dead, the victim isn't even a witness.
Right.
But under our legal definition of what a victim is, it includes for someone who's no longer alive, their family. So the family is a witness at best, potentially a witness for the prosecution, and nothing more than that. That means when a judge is issuing orders prior to trial, a judge can do all sorts of things to witnesses in the middle of trial, but before trial, a judge has no more business to tell Rebecca McAvoy's family that they should, you know, stand up straight or don't speak to the media than the judge has a right to order me up here in Massachusetts to say or do anything. The judge cannot command any person to do whatever the judge wants simply because he's a judge. And lots of good judges understand this. They know they have limitations on their authority. Their authority is tied to the case. The case is, by definition, a legal battle between the government and the accused. The people who care about how the case is going are not really under the judge's power unless and until they stand in court, take the oath, and become witnesses. Then a judge has power over them, but not before. So I told Rebecca McAvoy's family, and I tell all the victims and the families with whom I work, and I've been doing this for 20 years, if a judge tells you to jump, don't jump unless the judge has the power to tell you to jump, okay? This sounds so simple, but most people don't understand it. They think the judge can tell them what to do. They're trying to be good citizens. They don't want to appear disobedient. They just want a fair result. But every so often, you see this bubbling up of frustration. And it's a little bit like vigilantism, which I abhor. Vigilantism is the canary in the coal mine. It's the notion that we don't trust the system anymore. We're sick of getting the shaft. We don't like the disrespect. We're going to do things our own way. When you start to hear victims' families mobilizing and going on programs like yours and doing poster campaigns and protesting outside the courthouse, which, by the way, I completely support. I think it's not only good, but I think people have a duty to protest the government, including the judicial branch. The judicial branch is the government. We have a duty to protest when the government isn't getting the job done that it's supposed to do. So I think I give lots of points to families that put the energy into protesting and complaining and, you know, asking tough questions. And shame on anyone who thinks that the correct American response to that is to put a muzzle on, as if these people are dogs, threatening dogs with rabies. It is just grotesque, and I feel so bad for this family. But Dana, I wish I could say it's a rare case. I wish I could say I don't see this very often. What I can tell you is over the past 15 years that I've been doing volunteer work for victims and their families, I've seen more and more and more examples of victims and their families getting outraged, getting angry, mobilizing, using the internet, protesting, standing outside courthouses, picketing corrupt and bad judges. And we're just going to see more and more and more of it until the system finds a way to say, responsibly, we're not doing the public's job. We're not getting the job done the way we're supposed to. We're going to change the system. We've got a long way to go, I think, but we're quite on the fast track to disaster, in my opinion, and that's a lot of what my book is about.
And, you know, the amazing part of all these families, whether it's the McAvoy family or Denise Brown, who we'll be interviewing here in a little bit, she and I talked today and recorded an interview, it's been 14 years since her sister was murdered by O.J. Simpson, and they're having a candlelight vigil. The family's strength and how they continue on, not only fighting for their cause, but fighting for other causes, is just, it's amazing, and I think it's so heartwarming, and I'm sure we've got about 2 minutes left, Wendy, that you've seen a ton of that too, and it has to be special for you also.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a sad, bittersweet, I guess, thing to watch. Denise, and I know her, you know, we've been together at events, and I've certainly spoken to her many times. And I said to her once, you know, I give you credit because I figured you'd have been more of a flash in the pan. You know, do your work on behalf of the rights of women. For a few years and then move on when you felt healed or whatever, and she's still doing it. And I said, I just admire you so much. You're not doing it in the limelight or for the limelight. You're just doing it because it's something you believe in. And I'll tell you something funny. I could tell you stories and stories about clients of mine who, because of an injustice, completely changed their career path. Instead of going to medical school or veterinarian school or, you know, journalism school, they set themselves on a path to law school because they said they were so motivated by what they saw as a system in need of repair work. So I have a lot of former clients who not only began doing volunteer work for others, but literally became what I would call sort of soldiers in the movement, and they're lawyers now, and they're doing lots of volunteer work, and you know, it's heartening. It's hard stuff to do. You know, frankly, I'd rather be planting tomatoes and living a life of peace and no conflict, but it's very rewarding, and that's how I'll end it, Dana. It's rewarding for me because there isn't a lot of money in this work. There's a ton of stuff that needs to be done, which to me means even a little bit of energy I put in, I get a lot of bang for the buck in terms of making the world a better place, and I mean it in terms of this small little thing that I do, making the legal system a better place where people can truly get a better form of justice. I do a teeny bit of work, I get a real big result, so it's very satisfying. Frustrating, sad stories, but very satisfying for an attorney.
Well, we need more like you. Wendy, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks to Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye. And I did sit down with Denise Brown. We all know Denise is the sister of Nicole Brown, who was taken along with Ron Goldman 14 years ago. And there'll be a special candlelight vigil on June 12th in remembrance of them and other victims of violence. And here's what Denise had to say. Okay, we're back. On June 12, 2008, the 14th annual Candlelight Vigil in the memory of Nicole Brown and other victims of violence will be held between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m. in Dana Point, California, Salt Creek Beach Park, just below the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. They're asking that everyone light a candle in memory of your loved one. Bring your friends, bring a candle. And it's hard to believe that this has been 14 years now. So I thought I'd give my friend Denise Brown a call and talk about the vigil and the fact that it's been 14 years. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. You know, we were just talking off air, 14 years. Wow. It doesn't seem like that. You know, it seems like just yesterday. Your thoughts?
Well, and that's exactly what people are writing to me and emailing me back. They cannot believe that it's been 14 years since the murders of Nicole and Ron. And people are just as upset and still upset about it. And, you know, as of course are we, her family. And so we hold a candlelight vigil every year in memory of Nicole and Ron and all victims of violence.
You know,
Salt Creek Beach Park is where Nicole and I, when we first moved down here to Laguna, that's the beach that we hung out at when we were going to high school and when we were kids and, you know, going and sunbathing down at the beach. And so we've decided that that's where we're going to have our candlelight vigil because we used to hang out there. And it was good times and great memories. And, you know, we were young, just, you know, laying in the sun and playing in the ocean. You know, and so every year we do this candlelight vigil, and I swore that even if I were the only person standing out there with a candle, I will be there every year in Dana Point at Salt Creek Beach Park.
Well, you're not going to be the only person, that's for sure. And one of the comments you have on the email here says, to banish the darkness and end the silence, you know, the education aspect 14 years ago compared to today is huge. People still, though, sadly, are silent about these sorts of domestic violence issues, but yet the education has improved so much. I want you to compare 14 years ago to today.
Oh my goodness. Well, when I first started becoming educated, we found Nicole's notes and diaries, and I think I told you that before.
Yep.
And we went to a shelter here in Laguna, Human Options, and we asked them, you know, what is this all about? Because, you know, Nicole and I were so close. And close in age and close in everything that we did when we used to run around as children and, you know, even teenagers, we used to run around and have the same friends and do the same thing. So it was something that was a real eye opener for me, for my sister to keep this a dirty little secret like many victims of domestic violence do. And so when I started becoming educated about it, you know, they didn't want to talk about men. They didn't want to talk about, like, alcohol or drug abuse. They didn't want to talk about, there were no laws for law enforcement to go in and arrest somebody or to take somebody away. What they did is they went to the house and they went to the family and they said, okay, walk around the block.
Right.
Well, today's laws, they have to, you know, it's a mandatory arrest policy. Someone will get arrested if you call 911 on domestic violence. So a lot of things have changed. You know, there was a little bit of a backlash as far as law enforcement going in and arresting the wrong person. But, you know, that's improved as well now. Laws came out of Duluth, Minnesota when it came to law enforcement, and they were implementing it here in California and all across the country. So a lot of good, positive things have happened. And, you know, there's always room for improvement.
And
one thing that I'd like to see is some uniformity across our country when it comes to laws. So the victims of domestic violence, when they go from one state to another, they know what their laws are. They know what they can and cannot do, you know, and they have people working together instead of saying, okay, well, you know, you just crossed county line and I can't help you. You know, I'm hearing that way too often. So that's something that we're working on. And, you know, domestic violence didn't happen yesterday and it's not going to change overnight.
No, absolutely. But
unfortunately.
There's been
I wish it would.
Yeah, exactly. There's been so much good work done, though, but one thing that hasn't changed and won't change is the cycle of violence, honeymoon phase and all that sort of stuff. Let's go over that a little bit, because when we talk about the cycle of violence, that's one of the things that people really can't understand or maybe don't realize is out there.
Well, and that's exactly, oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's something that I knew nothing about, which was the cycle of domestic violence. When we found Nicole's notes and diaries, we said, oh my God, look at this, because she had documented 17 years of verbal, emotional, and physical abuse. I thought, my goodness. Then the shelter started educating me about the cycle of violence, the power and control wheel, because that's what it is. It's power and control of one human being over another.
Yep.
Then there's the verbal, emotional, psychological abuse, the chipping away at one's self-esteem, which is the, you know, the put-downs. You're stupid, you're ugly, you're worthless, nobody's going to want you, I'm the only one that cares for you, you know, things like that. And if you're told that over and over again, pretty soon you're going to believe that, hey, you're stupid, ugly, and worthless.
Yep.
And that escalates into the physical violence, the hitting, the kicking and punching, throwing up against walls. And then there's the honeymoon phase. And honeymoon phase is the, oh, baby, I'm so sorry, it's never going to happen again. The gifts, the flowers, and all the excuses. Well, that's the cycle of violence that I knew nothing about. And that's the cycle of violence that people need to be educated on. Because I thought, and I testify to an incident of domestic violence, and I thought it was an isolated incident. I thought, oh, my God, he went crazy, and, you know, this is what happened. I didn't know that it was a continuing cycle, that there's a good time, and then all of a sudden, you know, the gifts, the flowers. Yeah, Nicole had beautiful bouquets of flowers all over her home all the time.
Right.
Yeah, she got beautiful gifts. But, you know, I thought because this man loved her and wanted to have his wife have nice things. You know, so it's like, it was a real eye-opener, that cycle of domestic violence. And I say it in every one of my speeches. Whenever I go and speak, I talk about the cycle of violence. Then there's the financial control in the cycle of violence,
yep.
You know, which is huge. Where do I go? What do? I have no money because they are controlling all the finances.
No way.
Then there's the sexual abuse, which is the sexual control in a relationship. You know, there's a lot of rape that goes on in a relationship. And so, I mean, it's a cycle of violence that you need to learn about. There's, you know, you learn about the red flags of domestic violence. If somebody's constantly putting somebody down, you have to take a look at that relationship and just go, wow, you know, you don't deserve to be treated like that. And, you know, a lot of times it's the self-esteem, the self-worth, that doubt of, God, really, I am no good. You know, that creeps in slowly but surely, and then all of a sudden you're under this spell and under this control, and it's very difficult to get out of.
Yeah, so it is. And just before I let you go, Denise, and again, just to remind the folks, the 14th annual Candlelight Vigil in the memory of Nicole Brown and all victims of violence will be held June 12th from 8:30 to 9:30 p.m. at Salt Creek Beach Park. That's just below the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. You know, we educate the people, we educate the cops, but the courts is another thing. Are the courts doing a good job when it comes to these types of domestic violence cases, in particular the high-profile cases? I don't think you could get a bigger high-profile case than what your sister went through, and that creep Simpson is still walking around out there today. Well, let's talk about the courts a bit.
Well, the courts, they've got good judges, they've got bad judges.
Yeah.
You know, they've got the good old boys network that's still out there, and you know, people that think that either they're abusive or this doesn't happen. You've got, in different parts of the country, the Hatfields and the McCoys, people shooting each other over the fence.
Yep.
And, you know, people knowing the judges and they get away with it. You've got all kinds. And, yes, they are becoming more educated. Yes, the states are mandating domestic violence education. Some states, not all, which is really unfortunate. And it should be an ongoing process because I've been traveling now for the last 13 years trying to educate myself, going to prisons, women's prisons, men's prisons, shelters on, you know, every chance I get, I go to a shelter, see the women and children, go to the children's organizations, just try to educate myself on every aspect of domestic violence so I can understand it. And, you know, a lot of these judges think, well, I'm a judge, I know everything.
Yeah.
You know, they just think that they know all the laws and everything that there is to know. Well, you know, and then a lot of people come to me and they say, well, God, we need this law passed. There are so many laws on the books. It's just a matter of how, if it's written, if, or if what is written. And if, it, you know, you use a different word, a defense attorney can always figure out a way to get around it. So our laws really need to be written ironclad so that they're So that people like child molesters, pedophiles, you know, abusers, murderers, people like that, they can't get away with it.
Yeah, you're.
And that's the only thing that needs to be done. The laws are there.
So true.
Kids need to be educated on them.
So true. Again, June 12th, the 14th Annual Candlelight Vigil. The website, www.nicolebrown.org. Denise, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. And you know what? Just before I go, can I just say one thing that, you know, I'm sure not everybody across the country can come to this Candlelight Vigil in Dana Point. Light a candle. What we'd like to see is all the candles lit all across the country, around the world, on that evening between 8:30 and 9:30 to banish the darkness. And that's what that is all about, lighting the candles all across the world.
Absolutely. Well put. Thank you, Denise.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Denise Brown. We'll be right back.
The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio will be right back.
Okay, we're back. I apologize. We had a power surge, and we're back with my next story. If you go to the Women in Crime blog, you'll see that there is a story. I hope I can get through this. Maybe I'm getting too old and emotional, but it's an excellent story called Officer Rodney Johnson's Last Call. It's by Houston police officer Connie Park, and Rodney Johnson was a Houston police officer. I'm going to share a small part of the story with you. Officer Johnson stopped Juan Leonardo Quintero on traffic for speeding. Johnson handcuffed him and placed him in the back seat of his police cruiser. While Officer Johnson was sitting in the front driver's seat of the vehicle filling out paperwork, he was shot not once, but four times in the back of the head by the suspect he had handcuffed. Quintero had managed to retrieve a pistol from his waistband. Though he had been shot, Officer Johnson somehow was able to press the emergency button in his patrol car. That was the last thing Officer Johnson did before he died, the last call he made as a police officer. This scumbag, Quintero, of course, is an illegal immigrant, and it's such a heart-wrenching story, and there's a lot more to it, and I thought I would bring on one of the contributors to the Women in Crime blog and also a Houston police officer and friend of Rodney Johnson, Connie Park. Hi, Connie.
Hi.
I apologize.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm fine. I apologize for the power blinking out on us like that, but that's one of the things you have to put up with live radio. But, you know, we've done a lot of stories with the gals from Women in Crime, and it's an excellent blog. And this story, it got to me because there's so many aspects to it. Not only is there the loss of a police officer, how you're able to write about your friend, but the whole crime and punishment aspect of it, it gets right to your gut. And maybe because I'm also a police officer, that it affected me a little bit differently. But let's talk about your story.
Sure. Like I said on the blog, back in September 21st, 2006, you know, Johnson, Officer Rodney Johnson, worked the southeast side of Houston, where he mainly patrolled most of his career. At that day, around 5:30 p.m., he stopped Quintero on traffic. There was some altercation where I believe his girlfriend was with Quintero,
mm-hmm.
but Quintero was placed in the back of the patrol car handcuffed. I believe he was causing a disturbance, but Officer Johnson let his girlfriend take the car. That way, the car, Quintero's vehicle, didn't have to get towed.
Right.
So, you know, Officer Rodney handcuffed him, placed him in the back seat of the car. Like I said in the blog, he was sitting up front in the driver's seat, getting information. I believe he probably was getting information from Quintero, you know, all the identifiers, address, location. You know, routine paperwork we fill out as officers. And then you hear on the air, need a wrecker at, you know, 8900 block of Randolph. And, you know, that is the last transmission that Officer Johnson made.
It's so heart-wrenching, and we'll get into the, you know, the emergency button, the officer needs help part of this. But if you look at the blog, and again, go to the Women in Crime blog. We have a link to it on our webpage here. And if you look at Rodney Johnson, he's a big guy. Okay, he looks like a big fella. He looks like he can handle himself just fine. And he follows procedure. He handcuffs this guy. Okay, he had a gun. He shot him. He killed him. That happens. But people will say, how the heck did he get a gun while he's handcuffed in the back seat of the patrol car?
You know, somehow, I'm not too sure. Only Rodney could tell us
exactly
what happened. But I guess he just did initial search, and somehow that gun was hidden from view and, you know, was not found when he was placed in the car, in the back of the patrol car. Sometimes things escalate where, you know, you're not able to do a, you know, full body search right away, or, you know, it might have been hidden so well where, you know, the initial pat down might have not caught the gun originally.
And the whole aspect of this is certainly not to criticize the officer. I'm wanting the public to know how difficult it is as a law enforcement officer, even with a routine traffic stop, and the danger and the, you know, to expect the unexpected is there. And it is, you know, I'm sure when the officer pulled him over, he didn't know that he was an illegal alien armed, and he was going to kill this policeman in a matter of minutes. Let's go on with the story.
So he's filling out the paperwork, and somehow Contera manages to get the pistol. How he does it is he lays down on the seat of the back of the patrol car, and while he's handcuffed, he's retrieved the gun behind his back. Mind you, both his hands are behind his back. He leans over and points the gun and shoots Johnson in the back of the head several times, like I said in the blog, four times. And that's not the end of it. He shoots several other shots while the wrecker driver was approaching the vehicle, which was just, you know, I was there when the wrecker driver testified, when he was up in the stand. He saw Rodney Johnson lean over. He just thought, you know, the engine was running. He thought Johnson was filling out paperwork. And when the wrecker driver was approaching, he sees, you know, blood over the computer. And as he's trying to help Officer Johnson, three more shots are fired towards the wrecker driver.
Right.
And the wrecker driver retreats and calls for backup at that point. So even after he shoots Johnson in the back of the head, he continues to shoot at the wrecker driver. So this guy was, he did not care. He did not care that he was arrested. He shot an officer. You know, whoever approached the car, he was ready to kill some more. So just to even, you know, understand what goes behind or what are his thoughts at that moment is just unimaginable to me.
Right.
Go ahead.
That it's the desperation of it. You know, you are now, and I know that you didn't roll up on the scene, but the other officers are rolling up on the scene, or put yourself in the position of getting the officer needs help call, and you're rolling up on the scene. A lot of people don't understand how, you know, you go from in police work just to a normal everyday day to your adrenaline is running 500 times faster than it normally is, and you're rolling up in the scene and you're thinking and you're trying to make snap decisions and you're wondering what's going on and you're thinking about the officer. How badly is he hurt? Is he hurt? Is this just a combative suspect? What's going on? Take us to that point.
I mean, you explained it exactly the way we feel, Dana. You being as a police officer, there is nothing worse as a police officer to hear the transmission over the radio assist the officer. You hear two loud beeps, you know, on the radio, you know that's an emergency call, and you hear the dispatcher and officer requesting assist. And like you said, at that moment, you just don't know what's going to happen, what's going on. So, you know, you're rushing over to the scene as fast as you can, and then while you're trying to assess what's going on, you know, you just, your heart's beating fast, you feel the pit of your stomach, you just feel it drop, and it's so hard to express what you're feeling at that moment. Just, you want to be there for your fellow officer and help them out as quickly as possible, because you just don't know. That 1 second, Dana, changes everything in your life.
Well, you go from 8. 1 second. You go from 8 to 800 that fast, and I'm talking about your heart rate, your blood pressure, your everything, and it does. It changes everything in your life. Connie Park is here. She's a Houston police officer, and we're talking about Officer Rodney Johnson's last call, a Houston police officer that was killed by an illegal immigrant, Juan Quintero. Quintero gives a confession, Connie, to Sergeant David Ferguson. He confesses that he shot the officer because he thought that the officer had disrespected him. Let's clear that part of it up.
Well, the prosecutors showed the videotape confession of Quintero actually demonstrating how he physically lay down in the patrol car and shot the gun behind his back at Rodney. He said he disrespected him. Why didn't Rodney Johnson write him a ticket? Why did he have to arrest him? And that's why he shot. Just over a ticket that Rodney was going to issue him, and he was going to take him to the jail. And it's a class C.
Yeah.
Hey, pay your fine, and you'll be out of there. A Class C turned into a capital murder case where everybody's lives were affected just that 1 second. So, no remorse. He disrespected me. It's clearly shown in the videotape confession. He's demonstrated it. And I don't know what else could be demonstrated and clearly expressed to the jury.
Well, the confession should be just that, but unfortunately in this situation, I guess it's part of the system, Quintero goes in and he pleads not guilty by reason of insanity. It's a ploy, I guess, that probably everyone involved in the case shouldn't have been shocked with. But obviously he's convicted, but then it goes to the penalty phase, and I'll get you to take it from there, Connie.
From the penalty phase, I was fortunate enough to listen to the closing arguments from both sides, and I really have to commend our prosecutors, prosecutors Bradley and Jordan, who worked days and months, you know, to prepare for this, as well as investigators. You know, they did a great job. And listening to the closing argument, it was such a clear case of why Quintero shot the officer, giving a confession, demonstrating how he did it, the record driver, the transmission of Rodney's last call, the medical examiner's office showing us how he was shot, the angle, and all those things were, you know, expressed to the jury, and they just wanted the jury to interpret the law. Here are the facts, here are the evidence, and show us or come back with a decision that this case is indicative of a death penalty case.
Right.
Hands down. Now, the jury comes back, the defense attorneys come back, and they argue that Quintero sustained brain injury when he was living in Mexico as a kid. His dad was abusive. He was always hard on Quintero. and expected the most from him, that he was the black sheep of the family, but he was excelling in school and that he's good in art. You know, he had mechanical skills. So mainly, they're saying he perceived the threat that Rodney placed him in the back of the patrol car differently than most people would, and that the brain injury caused him to react that way, which is, I mean, it just flabbergasted me that that worked as an excuse for him to murder Rodney. You know, then in that case, we could argue millions of people who grew up abused,
yep,
in abusive families. That's going to be their case for committing these crimes.
Exactly. And it was a tactic. And the ADA, Jordan, and I'm going to quote from your article here, said, and I think he said it very well, you look for some humanity in this defendant. You look for some emotion, some heart, some soul in this defendant. You can watch it 20 times. He's talking about the videotape confession, and you won't find it. And then the prosecutor, Bradley, looked at Quintero directly and said, you're a threat in the backseat of a patrol car. You're a threat anywhere. We can't protect ourselves from Juan Quintero. And we could have a whole debate as far as capital punishment and the death penalty. But it's a public interest when it comes to death penalty cases. Can the public be protected from a guy like this? And as far as the tactic of using the brain injury to protect their client as far as death goes, I'll get you to report on that, Connie. What happened in this case?
You know, the defense attorneys, that's all they wanted. They knew, they expressed that, you know, that Quintero was guilty and that, you know, he just had a brain injury and that was his excuse for everything. And like I said, that sets the precedent for all these other criminals that are going to go to trial and plead guilty by reason of insanity and use that defense. Mental illness. You know, and they're saying that millions of people could react this way. So for them to use that, and he clearly knew what he was doing. He clearly knew what he was telling Sergeant Ferguson and demonstrating in that videotape. So I just don't, it just, you can't get a better death penalty case than this. Nothing so blatant and heinous like this crime.
It's so shocking. You know, and again, I'm having a hard time with my composure here because, you know, we talk about the family aspect, you know, police officers, and you have a certain respect for police officers when you, well, I grew up, my father was a police officer. I've been a police officer for 26 years, and I know thousands of police officers. We do this show about police officers and crime. And then you see a story like this, and not only was Officer Johnson a police officer, but he was married to a police officer. And I'll tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, it takes a special kind of person to be able to be married to a police officer, because we're not normal, okay? We do things that most normal people don't do, don't have to do, and we hope they never have to do. So when someone's married to a police officer and they're able to have a good marriage, and that your partner, your marriage partner is also a police officer, makes it also something special. And you know, I'm seeing a little bit here about Sergeant Jocelyn Johnson, again a friend of yours, and how's she doing after this? I know you probably have a very strong family of officers there in Houston, but this had to be devastating for her.
You know, I just can't imagine. Like I said in the blog, you know, I respect and look up to Jocelyn because the way she's handled things and the way she's, you know, taken care of the family and kept her composure up until this trial, she's a strong woman. I mean, more so than I could ever handle. And your heart just you know, goes out, Dana, and like you said, only police officers would know this. And I'm not saying citizens, you know, can't understand, but it's a bond that, you know, police officers all have, because, you know, you'll be, you know, there's that one night that you won't come home. You might not come home. So for her to realize, you know, receiving that call is just unimaginable to me. So, you know, but she's strong, and, you know, I really look up to her.
Quintero escaped the death penalty, sadly, and that's me saying that. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. And again, another whole topic that we could discuss another time would be the immigration status, and while he shouldn't have been in the country in the first place, but regardless, he still executed a police officer. And if you are able to escape the ultimate punishment by executing someone who is there to protect us, who will put his life on the line to save yours, and you don't have to give up your life for taking his, there's something wrong with that. Just quickly, Connie, your thoughts on the ultimate sentence.
Yeah, we were just floored. Like I said, there was, you know, this case was perfect case for a death penalty. I mean, I just, it was so brutal and so blatant that I couldn't imagine what other decision they could have come back with, you know, besides death penalty. I could even tell you what one of the jurors noted during the deliberation, that, well, Officer Johnson should have known. You know, he became an officer, so that was something that could happen to him.
Oh, jeez. Wow.
Oh, my gosh. You know, for me to hear that, you know, that just angers me so. That doesn't justify what Quintero did to take someone's life.
Yeah.
And working in homicide, I see that. And like I said, that 1 second in your life could change everybody's lives forever. And you can't turn back time.
You can't,
you know, change the things he did. He chose that decision, and he has to pay the consequences. That's why there's rules and laws that normal citizens obey and abide by. So, you know, for that decision, for her to think that, well, Officer Johnson should have known.
Yeah.
That was a danger when he took the oath to become a police officer.
Just quickly before I let you go, and again, Connie Park is here, and we're talking about Houston police officer Rodney Johnson's last call. It's an education, Connie, you know that. The public, jurors, the lawyers, the system, they don't know what we do. They can guess. They can maybe have a relative that was a policeman at one time, or they see something on TV, or they hear a show, or watch something, but they don't really know what we do when we sacrifice, when we put on the uniform or the badge and go out and do our jobs. And I want you all to remember the next time you get pulled over by a police officer, whether it's a female or male, and they're giving you a ticket, and you're madder than hell at them. They're doing their job. And remember, they're the ones that are walking down that back alley at night, and they're confronting the guy with the knife or the gun that they don't know what's happening, or they're putting someone in their back seat that they're giving a traffic ticket to that they don't realize has a gun, and they're going to be executed, and they're going to die, and their family is going to lose them that quickly. Connie, just a couple of final words from you, and again, I really appreciate you coming on. It's difficult, and I give you all the credit in the world, and I hope that when we have the show pieced together and it's up on the website, that you'll be able to sit back and listen to it with some of your fellow officers, and they'll know that you deserve all the credit in the world for writing this, first of all, because it's that message and that's that education that the public needs to know about what we do and the good work that officers like Rodney Johnson do every day.
Well, first of all, Dana, I'd like to thank you for having me on here and recognizing the story and giving light of what happened to Rodney. 2 years ago. And to let you know what kind of police officer Rodney was, during a house fire a couple years ago where someone was trapped inside the house, when everybody's running away to, you know, safely run away from the fire, Rodney went in, you know, risking his safety to get the person that was trapped in there, and he saved that person.
Yep.
So that's just indicative of what kind of person, first of all, Rodney was, and what kind of police officer he was. You know, unselfishly thinking about the safety of our citizens versus his. So that in itself explains what kind of person Rodney was. And, you know, just my heart goes out to Rodney's family, Jocelyn, the kids, and all the, you know, all the officers, officers' lives that he touched, and friends, and, you know, and people like you. You know, being a police officer for 26 years, like you said, you know, you know exactly what we're going through.
Absolutely.
A big loss in our hearts.
Absolutely. Thank you, Connie, and let's do this again real soon.
Thank you, Dana. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Houston PD Officer Connie Park talking about Rodney Johnson and the last call that he attended. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. I thought we'd end up the show on a lighter side tonight. And again, I apologize to those that I'm not sure if we lost some of the live listeners or not when the power blinked here. It's one of the things with live radio. Sometimes those things happen. But if you're listening on the podcast, you're going to wonder, what is he talking about? But just before my interview with Connie, the lights went out for about 30 seconds and then pop back on. But you'll recognize my next guest as the guy that went to an Elvis concert many, many years ago, and Elvis gave him a cup with water in it, and he ended up selling the water on eBay, and he has the cup, and he goes and tours on it. But Wade Jones also has been in the media lately saying that he has a sweet potato. I hate sweet potatoes, but anyway, it looks like Barack Obama. And he thinks that that's pretty important. So I sat down with Wade Jones, and we talked about his sweet potato and the political aspirations of same. Okay, we're back. Do y'all remember Wade Jones, the Elvis Cup guy? I don't know how you can forget him. With that type of celebrity and that type of pressure that's put on someone, it must be difficult, but it seems like things come in bunches, and our old friend Wade Jones now has another, I don't know if it's a blessing or if it's a curse. He has a sweet potato that looks like Barack Obama, and of course you can see that on eBay, and just check the webpage for the link. And I thought I'd bring Wade Jones back on to talk about the sweet potato that looks like Barack Obama. How weird is that? Hi, Wade.
Hey, now what's going on, my man?
What's going on with you? You know, we went from the Elvis Cup, you still have that, and all the fame and adulation that came with it, to now a sweet potato that may look like the next president of the United States. Let's talk about how you came across it.
Well, I tell you what, man, I try to get out of the damn spotlight. I can't.
Okay.
You know, whatever direction I turn, it happens. You know, the Elvis Cup, the Elvis water, and now this Barack Obama sweet potato just absolutely came out of nowhere. Let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
Last Sunday, I was at a local grocery store. I don't know if you guys have Food Lions up there, but it's kind of like a Costco.
Sure.
Or a Bilo, Harris Teeter, or whatever you have.
Yep.
But I was walking through the produce section. Somebody noticed my Barack Obama little bracelet I was wearing, and they asked me where I got it. I was standing near the sweet potatoes, and as they walked away, I looked down. I saw a sweet potato with a face on it,
right,
had a mouth and two eyes. I picked it up, and like a lightning bolt, it hit me. I said, "Oh my God, this is a Barack Obama sweet potato." Not that I was really, I've never ever looked for food that looks like a celebrity, ever.
No.
I've heard of, you know, the Jay Leno, Dorito.
Right.
Heard of, a Joan Rivers, Bugle.
Yeah.
I've heard of a Jack Klugman pretzel. but I've never looked for it. And I swear to God, I picked this thing up, and I was like, oh, my God, this is Barack Obama. I went home, put it on eBay, and I said, hey, you know what? It is a bigger Obama supporter than I am. You know, let him bid on it. I don't care. It just struck me so hard. I'm offering the Barack Obama sweet potato and the bracelet I was wearing that day in one auction. Closes tomorrow, 3 o'clock p.m. EST, Eastern Standard Time. And it's got three bids so far. You can go to the website, type in Obama sweet potato, see the video link. A few local news stations have done stories on it. A few blogs, a few websites, a few newspapers. And, hey, man, I don't care. Somebody buy it. It's just too freaky for me.
You know, you talk
all
to...
It's all I can do. But with this Elvis cup.
You know, you
don't need this. I don't need it.
Wade, you talked about the snack foods that look like celebrities, but have you researched the vegetables that look like presidential candidates? Are you, one of the first here?
Look, I heard a rumor maybe about 7 or 8 years ago that there was an avocado that looked like Gerald Ford. I never checked the damn thing out. I mean, I never thought it would get this far, Dana.
Right. Well, you know, I've seen the picture, and I'll keep my own opinion to myself here.
Look. Are we censored here?
Yeah, we're taping.
Okay. What the hell do you think it looks like?
Well, you know, I did
it. Barack Obama.
Now, we got to assume that you are an Obama supporter. And do you think that the Obama sweet potato will help finally put the rest, put to rest this whole Democratic primary thing between Hillary and Barack? And are you going to be looking for a vegetable that resembles Hillary Clinton? And if so, what sort of vegetable?
Well, let me tell you what. In 96, I had a Dole pineapple that looked like, of course, Bob Dole.
Right, of course.
But eBay was not invented yet. I wasn't even online. So, I mean, I put an ad in the local Penny Saver, and nobody bid on it.
Right.
So, no, you know what? I think Hillary has nailed her coffin shut with the RFK comment.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and I can't believe that. So it's done. So, you know, Barack potato, sweet potato, yes. I think it'll go all the way. I've been on the lookout, quite honestly, for a McCain candied yam or perhaps a turnip. But, man, I tell you, I'm not going to fake it. You know, this just happened upon me, the Barack Obama sweet potato. I've got a few people out looking for a similar vegetable item that looks like McCain, but you know, unless it's like a turnip or perhaps a carrot or maybe some ginseng or something like that, it's not going to hold a candle.
Listen, Wade, I appreciate you coming on, and you know, fame does follow those that that deserve it. And with the Elvis Cup, the Obama sweet potato, I'm not sure what's next for you, but I'm sure it'll be interesting.
Well, let me just remind you one last time, and all your listeners, please go to www.elviscup.com to check out the Elvis Cup tour photos, information, and how to contact me.
Absolutely. Thanks, Wade.
Okay, well, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, goodbye.
You know, when I look at that Obama sweet potato, it reminds me of today's commentary and Sharon Stone. I won't take it any further than that. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.